What's up, Stitches? Welcome back to So What with me, your pal, Isabella Rosner. Thanks for being here today. Today's episode is our first interview with returning guests, which I think is really exciting. It's a conversation with Dr. Lucy Whitmore and Dr. Bethan Bide about their exhibition and book, Fashion City. I first spoke to Lucy and Bethan on the 29th of April, 2021, in episode 13 of season 2 of So What, about what was at that time their research project on Jewish fashion makers in London in the late 19th through 20th centuries. It's thrilling that their research project turned into a major fashion exhibition at the Museum of London, which is on right now, and an accompanying book published by Bloomsbury. Before I get into everything like my classic social media spiel and Lucy and Bethan's bios, I'd like to just say here that this is a conversation, exhibition, and book about a community of migrants who just happen to be Jewish. There is no conflation of Judaism and Zionism here, and therefore no discussion about the extremely distressing events happening in the Middle East. This is about people in Jewish communities in London, and it's about migration, fashion, skill, and labor. Okay, now let me tell you about how to find the images that accompany this episode. You can see images of everything we discuss by finding us at So What Podcast, SEWWHAT Podcast, on Instagram, Twitter, you will not catch me calling it X, it's Twitter, and Facebook. We also have a website, sowhatpodcast.com, with episodes and images. Yeehaw! So, today I am joined by Dr. Lucy Whitmore, who is fashion curator at the Museum of London and is the lead curator of Fashion City, How Jewish Londoners Shaped Global Style. Lucy has a PhD in First World War fashion from the University of Glasgow. She has published on the subjects of First World War mourning dress and austerity fashion. And I'm also joined by Dr. Bethan Bide, who is a design historian and the academic advisor to Fashion City. She is lecturer in design and cultural theory at the University of Leeds and director of the Passold Research Fund. Bethan previously worked as a producer of comedy programs for BBC Radio 4. And now, before we get started, we are almost done. I promise one more thing. Sometimes my sound gets a little weird. You should be able to hear everything just fine, but sometimes my sound quality in this interview sounds a bit like I'm in a cave. Okay, now you know. Let's get into it. Lucy, Bethan, thank you so much for being here today. You're my first returning guests, and I cannot wait for our conversation.
Thank you. It is such an honor to be back.
Yeah, I can't believe we're the first ever returning guests. I feel like everybody would want to come back.
Thank you so much. So today we're here to talk about Fashion City, which is now an exhibition at the Museum of London and a book by the same name. And it's all about Jewish fashion makers in London from the late 19th through the 20th centuries. And last time you were on the podcast back in like early 2021, it was just a research project. So what I want to know and what I think So What listeners would be really interested in learning is how did you take it from a research project into an exhibition and a book? I think it's so exciting that from your two minds came this, I don't know, two very public facing outputs.
So yeah, it's been a really interesting process. We had a little bit more kind of support and recognition on the research project in between then and now. We got a small grant from the Passold and ran some really interesting workshops, one of which was with the Jewish Museum in London. And we did more kind of community workshops and events, speaking to some synagogues around London, and kind of gained traction and interest in the project, which was really wonderful to see that there was a lot of interest and people responded really, sometimes quite emotionally, but always in a very engaged way when we spoke about this research. And people from all sorts of different cultural backgrounds felt a kinship with this story of migrants and the descendants of migrants working in the fashion industry. So we pitched it as an exhibition to the Museum of London, which is where I work, in summer 2022. Mm. We were delighted that they said yes. This is the first time in 20 years that the Museum of London has done a fashion exhibition. It's the first time we've ever had a fashion exhibition at the Museum of London Docklands. Mm. And it is the first time that the Museum of London has ever done a major exhibition which centres on London's Jewish history. So it's a big moment.
We really wanted there to be a lasting legacy from the exhibition as well, which is where the book comes in. So we had, because it had been a research project that had been so many years in the making, we had so many ideas and so many people that we wanted to talk about and so many fantastic stories. And of course, there is a limited space in an exhibition. So we wondered if the book would be a way of doing a bit more kind of in-depth work on some of the wonderful stories that we feature in the exhibition. So the book came out of there. So the book is very much the accompaniment to the exhibition. It takes you on a very similar journey through time and space of London, but it just is able to do a little bit more kind of deep dive into some of that. So they're a really lovely pairing. But as I said, for us, I think it was really important to have something that would stick around and kind of be a testament to the fantastic stories that people had told us and the importance this project had to so many people we'd spoken to. Lucy and I have been blessed with a joyous working relationship where, you know, we really enjoy the real collaborative stuff. And actually, that's kind of how the book was written. It was very collaborative. It was sort of us sitting down together and writing together and bashing out ideas together. And that was, I said, a very organic process, actually, from the way that we'd done the research. So that was really joyous. And I think, you know, my kind of top tips for anybody who would want to be thinking about the mechanics of how you go about doing this is working with people that you really trust, you think their work is great, and also that you working with people who are kind of generous. Because I think one of the things that has been such a joy on this project is Lucy and I are both fantastically interested in it. We want to do loads on it, but we're also not kind of this is mine about it. And I think in academia that happens sometimes, in research that happens sometimes, and it's very destructive as a process in terms of actually what you can put out there. So I think one of the reasons for me why the book is such a joy and the exhibition is such a joy is because we have benefited hugely from other people's generosity and loads of other people who have contributed really brilliant stuff. So our friend Liz Tregenza, who's a fantastic expert on wholesale couture, gave us loads of ideas and has really helped us out. And I think both the book and the exhibition, Lucy, I feel like testaments to kind of academic generosity and partnership as well. Not to be too idealistic, but kind of,
No, I think that's such an important point. People, you know, a museum exhibition is so different to an academic output, and you don't you know, you can't use kind of citations in the same way within an exhibition. So of course, when you are digging for research, sometimes it's difficult, you kind of come across roadblocks. So that generosity has been so important. But I also want to say Bethan's been very modest, because she very much did the lion's share of the coordinating on the book and was a brilliant editor, because I went down some real wormholes. I mean, there's a version of this book where two whole chapters are just gossip about the Rava sisters. And, you know, Bethan made the heartbreaking but very practical decision that couldn't be this book.
I honestly, every time I think about it, I'm like, was that the worst editing decision I ever made? It may well be, Lucy. It may well be.
No, I think you made the right choice.
You need a gossip-based sequel, though, because I really want the hot goss. I like so much how you guys work together and how you work so well with other people, because it's really nice to see this sort of community coming together to create an output about something that is based around a community. There's a nice parallelism between a community working on researching and loving and celebrating a community.
We've talked there about kind of, you know, contacts and the academic world, but this whole exhibition and book are built on the personal stories of individuals, whether people telling their own story, like David Sassoon, or family members of people who worked in the industry, or their friends, or people, their employees. That is the absolute heart of what Fashion City is. So I'm sure we'll get to some of those stories in a moment, but it's such an important part of the project.
Absolutely. And it just was testament at the opening of the exhibition, how many families and people who knew people who were featuring the exhibition were there. And it was just kind of this glorious celebratory homecoming of all of these people. I said, kind of, I don't know, coming home to the Fashion City, if that makes any sense. But it felt like everybody belonged in this space with clothes that they'd made or their families had made. And it was a really magical moment for me, said, seeing all of those people who'd helped us so much in this space.
Okay, we got to get into the content of the exhibition and book. I realize this is a big ask, but could you take us on a walkthrough of both?
Shall I start with the East and pass over to you for the West, Lucy?
So love.
We say this because both the book and the exhibition are very much a sort of geographical journey through London as a fashion city. So we wanted to kind of push the boundaries of what people think London fashion is. So it's not just the West End. It's not just kind of glamorous Mayfair. Actually, it's across the whole city. So we start both the exhibition and the book in London's East End, which is obviously very appropriate because the Museum of London Docklands is in the East End. So that's where you are. And we start the exhibition with a kind of moment of arrival, because so many of the people who work in London's fashion industry throughout the late 19th and 20th centuries are migrants. So we start by thinking about people's journeys to London and how fashion was a way that many people built their lives in this new city. So fashion was a way that, you know, if you had kind of previous skills, which huge numbers of Jewish migrants in the late 19th century did, lots of people coming had kind of tailoring and shoemaking skills. And of course, therefore, it was a natural place for them to go. But also because there were loads of fashion makers, there were job opportunities. So if you arrived without a job, it was a place that could kind of give you some stability and help you start out. So we start, as I said, both the book and the exhibition by kind of talking about some of those journeys. And they're not all the same journey. There was no one route that people took through this process. But we feature a couple of people. So there is Sophie Rabin, who absolutely fascinating woman who sort of built her life as a dressmaker. But we also wanted to talk through some of the places that you might have gone. So we talk about education. We talk about the Jews Free School, which is a hugely important institution in training people, helping them get jobs in the fashion industry. And we talk about tailoring. So East End is really, really known as a kind of hotbed of ready-made menswear tailoring. That is what it becomes internationally famous for in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So in the exhibition, you will go into our immersive tailoring studio and it'll kind of give you, I was about to say, it's one of my favorite spaces. It just gives you that kind of sense of all of the skills that these people had, because one of our challenges when we are talking about some of these kind of earlier migrants, some of the experiences of these people, is we have statistics. We know from the censuses, huge numbers of people. We have sort of some records of people. We have some names, but actually an awful lot of people's stories are quite hard to capture. They're the kinds of stories that weren't recorded. So we've done all sorts of interesting things in the book and the exhibition to try and kind of capture those stories and bring them out. And then one of the final really interesting sections of the East End is our crossing paths section, where we talk about different communities who have crossed paths with Jewish fashion makers and companies. So we have the stories of a Bengali seamstress. We have the stories of a Jamaican tailor who both worked for Jewish companies at various points, but pointing out that the East End of London has always been this point of arrival, and the fashion trades have always been a place where people have established their lives. So that is both important for the fashion city, but it's amazingly important for individuals and their identity and their sense of belonging as a Londoner as well. I think that's really come across in some of the people we've spoken to. Lucy, I feel like I need to pass over to you to talk about the Tube, because...
Oh my God, you have to talk about the Tube. I loved the Tube.
So this is, you have to come to the exhibition if you want to see the Tube, because we couldn't work out a way to translate this into book form. But because our exhibition space at the Museum of London Docklands is made up of two large galleries with a little corridor between them, we felt it was only right in this geographic exploration of the city that that corridor become the central line. So once you have finished in the East End of the exhibition, you make your way into our Tube tunnel, which starts at Liverpool Street and takes you through to Oxford Circus. And we worked with a fantastic AV producing company who are called AP, and they made a glorious Tube soundscape. So I would encourage people to just pause for a moment, enjoy listening to the platform announcements. And it's fun, and it's a sort of playful way to join the exhibition. But actually, there's some really wonderful history behind it. There's a fantastic book about the Jewish population living in the West End of London by Jerry Black, who is our favourite, I think, historian of Jewish London. And we've drawn on his work so much. It's really important. And in this book, people say, like, oh, you know, it was actually kind of great when the central line joined these two thriving Jewish communities in the East End and the West End. And it made it that much easier for East Enders to go up and work in all of the, you know, the fashion, sort of the department stores and the workshops of the West End. There's this evidence to suggest that this was a big moment, that the central line joining these two centres. So in the exhibition space, when you step out of the tube tunnel, you arrive in the West End, and our exhibition designer Skellen did a wonderful job of giving a sort of distinct feel to the two halves of the exhibition. And when you come out in the West End, you will see a sort of sweeping colonnade of Regent Street with our high street shops. And then throughout that part of the exhibition, and again in the book, we look at the different kind of making and retailing spaces of the West End. And this was an important moment of myth busting because, you know, as Bethan said, a lot of people will associate fashion in London with the West End, but they will associate Jewishness in London with the East End. So in the exhibition, we bring those things together. So in the West End, we have a variety of making and retailing spaces. And that includes high street shops, it includes a sort of Fitzrovia dressmaking workshop. We have the couture salons in Leafy Mayfair, and we have a swinging 60s and 70s menswear boutique. So in the exhibition, those spaces have quite different feels to them. There's different soundtrack, there's music, there's design that makes you feel like you are exploring the kind of geographical sweep of the West End. And in the book, we've managed to dive into a little bit more detail, bring in, you know, a bit more, a few more businesses that we weren't able to include in the exhibition, and kind of touch on what brought all of these Jewish designers, makers and retailers together in the West End of London. In the exhibition, we end with a really, really poignant story of a wedding dress designer called Nettie Spiegel. And she's at the end of the exhibition because it was the tradition for fashion shows, couture fashion shows, to end with a wedding dress. And we have this beautiful wedding dress that was donated to us in the last couple of years. And it felt like such a lovely way to finish the exhibition, to finish the story. And the story of Nettie Spiegel is so poignant. She came to London on the Kinder Transport, used the fashion industry to build a life for herself, and became so beloved and is so well remembered today. So it was a really lovely way to think about legacy. But we actually used that story to open the book rather than end it. And that was kind of, we've actually called it a sort of prelude in the book. It's a way of understanding the types of journeys that can be experienced. And in this case, we're talking about somebody who was Jewish, who was born in Germany, whose entire family was killed in the Holocaust, and, you know, traveled to London, reliant on the kindness of others, and later in her life paid that kindness back. But it's not, you know, there are so many stories in London's history of migrants from all over the world seeking the same safety and following the same kind of path. So it was a really lovely way to set the tone of the book.
And I think her story as well feels so important at the start of the book, because it highlights that fashion really matters, that, you know, kind of making and beautiful objects, because she made absolutely beautiful bespoke dresses, beautifully beaded objects, you know, really stunning pieces. And they're the kind of pieces that people might go, oh, well, that's beautiful, and walk past and think, as if they're frivolous. But actually, her story is really about how fashion anchors us. It's a way we communicate with people. It's a way we celebrate special moments in our lives. It brings us together, you know, and the kind of the way we use fashion to realize our personal dreams, to reinvent ourselves, to give us new opportunities. I said that, I think, really, really matters for me, because actually throughout the book and the exhibition, we talk over and over again about how fashion matters. Yeah, and I think Nettie Spiegel's story just encapsulates that.
That's so good. Fashion is everything. Textiles are everything. They are the, like, literal fabric of our lives. I also think it's really good that the exhibition ends where the book begins. It's this thing about, you know, the beginning is the end. The end is the beginning. There's this really pleasing and, I don't know, meaningful cyclicality there. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next question. So in the introduction of the book, David Sassoon, a Jewish fashion maker, says, I became aware of the Jewish involvement in the London fashion industry when I started working and met agents of the leading luxury fashion fabric companies and lace and embroidery houses that we used. And I, an embroidery fan, was like, hoo-hoo, embroidery, hello. So can you tell us more about the presence of embroidery and needlework more generally in this book and exhibition? I feel like that is what the So What fans want to hear all about.
Absolutely, yes. Delighted to talk about this.
And
just want to kind of dive in with saying that we are so grateful to David Sassoon for writing that forward for us. It was such an honour to work with him on this project. And he is somebody who really excelled in his use of textiles. That is, to me, what set Belleville Sassoon apart and what elevated them was the extraordinary texture and pattern and detail. The coat that we loaned from Bath Fashion Museum that is in the exhibition, which was worn by Princess Diana on the day she announced her pregnancy with Prince William, the texture of that fabric is extraordinary. It's this really sort of chunky woven wool in like primary colours, and it could be sort of childlike, but it's just exquisite, the sort of blend of colour that they brought together. Elsewhere in the exhibition, we have some amazing examples of sort of mastery of textiles. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think a really nice example is the lace dress that features in the couture section. And this was made by a designer called Isabel, sometimes known as Madame Isabel, who navigated her own unique path through the fashion industry, I think we could say. She is somebody who started out as a court dressmaker, sort of aspired to be a couturier and was creating designs of an incredibly high quality, but later sort of went more into the ready-to-wear side of the industry. She was quite clever in sort of forging her own path. But the dress that we have in the exhibition is one of only a handful, we think 4 or 5 pieces made by Isabel to survive today. She seems to have been very big in her time. It is extraordinary that there are so few. So this dress is from around 1930, and it's made from this beautiful black lace with this unusual sort of contemporary for the time design of sort of looping circles. It almost looks like it's been scribbled. I was really lucky to speak with Dr. Gail Baxter, who is incredibly knowledgeable on lace and the history of lace in Britain. And she helped us identify this lace as being Nottingham Lever's lace. And that is such an interesting piece of information, because one of the things that Isabel really pushed was British manufacture and British fabrics. She was a real champion of this. And she wrote very opinionated pieces about it in the journal The Maker Up. So it's really lovely to be able to identify this. And we know that she used the same lace again in later collections throughout the 1930s, because there's a fantastic photograph of one of them, which is beautifully backlit so that you see the circular design. So I think that's a lovely piece, and we were really lucky. It was in a really poor condition, but the Costume Society supported the conservation of that piece, and so it's the first time it's ever been displayed.
The exhibition and the book both also feature some just incredible beading. I think it's when you sort of wander through the exhibition, when you flick through the book, you'll hopefully get a real sense from the pictures and just said seeing these objects in real life, the range of really, really stunning beading in very creative designs. And that is present in that beautiful Nettie Spiegel wedding dress we were talking about earlier on. Absolutely incredible beading there. But particularly, and I think one of my favourite places it really comes through, is in Peggy Lewis's dressmaking workshop. So Peggy Lewis was a bespoke dressmaker operating in London's West End, just off Tottenham Court Road. And she specialised in making beautiful beaded evening dresses. And the museum was lucky enough, I think probably about 20 years ago, to acquire a couple of them from relatives. And then we were in touch more recently with her grandson, who again has helped us get hold of another couple of pieces that are kind of in progress pieces. So actually, if you go to the exhibition, you're able to see some of those unfinished pieces, which kind of show you some of the process. So actually you can see inside, and you can see the kind of, I mean, the laboriousness of how long it would have taken and how much skill it would have taken to do that kind of really intensive beading, because you can see all of the stitches on the back. And I think the kind of, yeah, I said the time and the energy, we really wanted that craftsmanship and that workmanship to come across. And I think her grandson remembers the workroom with these kind of absolutely gorgeous bales of cloth under the tables, and this beautiful light-filled workroom, which obviously you would have to have a light-filled workroom if you were doing that kind of detailed embroidery work, and you know, all of these sort of sequins everywhere. So we've really enjoyed looking at some of those. And actually, one of the dresses featured in it was one of the first objects we really looked at, Lucy, wasn't it? Great dress, yeah.
Yeah, so the sort of olivey green dress, which features both in the exhibition and in the book, was pretty much the first thing that Bethan and I started this research project with 4.5 years ago. And one of the reasons that we feel it to be such an important piece is not only its beauty and its impact and the embroidery, which I really want to talk to you about, Isabella. But because everything about that dress and the story of its maker defies the expected image that people may have held in their mind of who a Jewish person was working in London's fashion industry, because there's an expected stereotype of probably a menswear tailor in the East End working in a dark and cramped workshop, and it being quite, you know, poverty stricken and somewhat depressing. And that image has built up due to the anti-Semitic treatment of Jewish people in the early 20th century in London. But the story of Peggy Lewis working in this bright and airy Fitzrovia, you know, workshop, which she owned herself, it was her business. And they were doing this bespoke women's wear that was high quality and beautiful. It just kind of totally counters the image that some people may have expected to experience. But I would love to know your thoughts on the embroidery, because it's probably I think that is my favorite object in the exhibition. And we have done a little bit of a deep dive into particularly that panel on the skirt, which seems to have this sort of historic referencing. So please, we would love to hear you do your thing.
Yes. Okay, so yes, you say in the panel at the end, here they have referenced early 1600s Jacobean crewel work patterns in the embroidery designs. I think it's so interesting to look at this dress, which is, you know, it's what, circa 1950, and it is so 50s in shape and even in the materials, but the embroidery very much harkens back to early modern Britain. So in the front of like the chest area, you have these two coiling stems. This thing called a ronceau, that's a coiling stem, and I'm obsessed with them. That's like all I do is talk about 17th century ronceau, because they were so present for quite a long period of time within the history of British embroidery. And here they are again, like what, 350 years later?
Yeah.
But made better, right? Made like using these kinds of, I remember you talking about some of like the beading and stuff. It's like cellulose or something.
It's right? gelatin.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so yeah. I could talk about these sequins for days because I love them. And my fantastic colleague, Janneke, who's one of our conservators, was equally interested. So she bought on Etsy some pre-war or interwar 3D puffed gelatin sequins that looked very similar, to run tests on them. And actually, sorry, when I say she didn't know at that point that they were gelatin, and she ran tests on them to find out what they were made from. And that's how we learned what these were on Peggy Lewis's embroidery. So they are gelatin. We know that that stock that she used was very, very, very likely to be from the 1930s. So she kept it through the war and then used it in 1950, which is very interesting. But I will let you carry on.
That is so interesting. But it's this, yeah, right. It's this 20th century material that she is using to create something that really harkens back to this kind of quote, I'm putting this in quotation marks, traditionally British embroidery style, this thing that becomes very conflated with with early modern England and with people kind of adorning themselves in a very stylized type of naturalism. So you have this kind of Ronceau thing happening at the chest, but then at the skirt, you're right, you have these, I don't know, they kind of look like they're tumbling, these kind of tumbling curves and big leaves. And within some of the leaves, she has this kind of trellis pattern. It's also Jacobean, this idea of Jacobean crewel work, which is interesting considering the fact that in this period from, well, like the 1920s through probably the middle of the century, it was really popular amongst women in the home to stitch Jacobean crewel work for, you know, their domestic spaces. It was chair covers and fire screens and wall hangings and pillow covers. But to see it on the body in a way that takes clearly inspiration from this thing, but then makes it incredibly modern is awesome. I think that is so cool because she manages to get the colors pretty, like the colors feel very reminiscent of how crewel work faded over time.
Yeah.
Leaves would go from green to blue and you have all these kind of blue sparkles and you have these kind of faded pinks, but it's not thread, it's bead, it's sequin, it's what sparkles in light.
I mean, I have spent a lot of time wondering what inspired it. You know, it's that kind of fascinating moment of being like, is this, as you said, is this something that was a kind of domestic fashion that she was quite into? Had she, you know, been to the V&A and sort of pressed her nose up against the glass? And I kind of love that idea of going, actually, where did these things come from and get translated? Because as you said, she seems to have such an interesting take on it, and the kind of naturalism of it and the colors of it. So it's so many more questions. That's what I love about these objects, is they always have more questions that you want to know about what people are doing.
I think from what you've just said, Isabella, like, it just really deepens that point that this is somebody who is so knowledgeable. Like, there is so much historical knowledge that she has had to produce that design. So it really supports that sort of argument that we're making about the importance of the skill and creativity that migrants and their descendants have brought to London's fashion industry. And I think it's really nice to the garments that Bethan referenced, the unfinished garments, you can see the way they're photographed in the book. You can kind of see some of that stitching that is underneath. And actually the cover of the book is one of those garments, and we really, really wanted an unfinished garment on the book, even though you can't see the unfinished nature of it on the cover specifically, but sort of symbolically it's about that ongoing process of making fashion. But in the exhibition, the way we have presented those unfinished objects is on a workbench. So they're sort of laid out flat, and we have a few little extra props with them, a thimble and some sewing thread, some needles, and some little dishes of those amazing gelatin sequins. And those are there to help our visitors understand this story of the hand of the maker and the skill of the maker, and just think about the process of producing fashion.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there is the sort of skill of the maker is present in so many different types of needlework throughout the exhibition. So there is a fantastic tailored suit made by a Jewish tailor in Hoxton, and we don't know who made it, so we don't have a name for it. So it is, alas, a kind of unnamed tailor, but the conservators, when they were mounting it, said it was the most beautifully made piece in the exhibition. And the kind of, you know, as I said, that real needlework skill of somebody whose name we haven't remembered is just present in the way that it hangs, the drape. You can really get a sense of how beautifully put together this garment is. And as I said, I hope that we've tried really throughout this story to foreground those skills. And like I said, the importance of those needlework skills to the success of the industry, really.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job of showing that, because I think now we live in this world of fast fashion where we forget that clothing should and historically has taken time, and that it involved great amounts of skill to produce these items. I think throughout the exhibition and book, you can really feel in each garment the immense amount of time and labor and skill that it involved.
Yeah, and if I could just say one thing on that, people who visit the exhibition or read the book will see that we don't only talk about finished garments, we also mm-hmm. have social history objects such as the tools used to make them. And that was really, really important for us. And we've tried in the way that they have been presented to elevate them as well. You know, they might be seen as more humble objects compared to, you know, a beautiful finished sparkly dress. But those tools are such a vital part of the process, and the human mastery of those tools is what we are, you know, celebrating in a lot of cases. And one of my absolute favorite objects in the exhibition is a sewing machine. It's a commercial sewing machine that was used at home by mm-hmm. the Bengali seamstress that Bethan mentioned earlier, who was called Anwara Begum. And Anwara was one of many Bengali women who came to London in the kind of mid to late 20th century and settled in the East End in the Spitalfields area. And she worked from home whilst caring for her children, mm-hmm. Producing mostly leather garments and accessories for both Bengali and Jewish owned companies in the East End. But she also made clothes for her family on that machine. Mm-hmm. And her daughter, Asma, who has been so incredibly generous with sharing her family story with us, speaks about the respect and love that they have for that machine in their family. Yes. Mm-hmm. Her mother very sadly passed away. And before she died, she said to her children, like, please, you know, keep the machine. It's so important. She called it her lucky charm. She spoke of it as an heirloom, and that is something that her children have really honoured. So they did decide to give the machine to the Museum of London a few years ago, as a way of preserving its legacy and the legacy of their mother. And we have it on display in the exhibition. And I really hope that people understand mm-hmm. the way we've tried to elevate that story. And we were really lucky that Asma agreed to do a recording, so you can stand listening to Asma tell the story, who obviously yeah. tells it far better than I ever could. Yeah. So you can hear her voice and how much that object meant to them. So that was a really important thing for us to get across too.
And I love the machine because it's so beautifully laid out in that case. You said it's really elevated, but also it feels like she's just stepped away from it because it is ready to sew. And I mean, heads up to the fantastic techs who worked on it, because they built a kind of mock plug, so it's plugged in, so it really does feel like it's ready to sew. So yeah, I said real credit to the whole exhibition team was fantastic, but thank you techs for that, because it's wonderful.
Yeah, the technicians and the conservators are so vital to the storytelling that you can do with objects and exhibitions, and I never ever think they get enough credit for it. The technicians at the Museum of London are absolute wizards.
Shout out to the technicians and the conservators. And something I think that's so nice is that clearly all of you, the technicians, the conservators, both of you, everybody involved, came together and kind of shared a common goal, which is the emphasis on people. It's, you know, she just walked away from her sewing machine. It's about the people who were stitching all of these garments. It's not necessarily just about the garments themselves, but the people who made them. And I really appreciated that.
I think that's a nice opportunity to mention the fact that in both the exhibition and the book, we are extremely aware that there are thousands of stories that we have not included. And that is a testament to just how huge a story this is. I mean, for new arrivals in London in general, as Bethan mentioned earlier, the textile industries were often an anchoring point where you could start a new life and you could find stability through work. But in this instance, particularly for Jewish migrants coming to London, you know, you've got around 100,000 Eastern European Jewish migrants settling in London in the late 19th and early 20th century. And around 60% of those adults were working in the garment trades broadly. So for every single story in the exhibition, there were other people within the same families working in the industry, and then thousands of others, you know, unrelated. But that it is just so, it's so overwhelmingly massive that we could never have included everyone. The exhibition would simply never end. So it just, that you know, that's why this exhibition exists. It is such a huge story, and it is so personal for so many people. And But I think that's why we've been able to tell stories in such a human-centered and personal way, because it is still a living story. It's very much in living memory, and people are passionate about recognizing what their ancestors have brought to this industry in London, and so have been very generous about sharing that information with us.
That is wonderful. And speaking about these populations, these people, I need to ask about the organization of the book, because I really, really like how you organized it. You focus on types of fashion being made and then the key figures within each of those movements and locations. So you have chapters on like the East End, high street chains, couture and bespoke dressmaking, et cetera, et cetera. So what are your favorite chapters and people within them?
Such a hard question, but in a kind of great way. I mean, you know, I love a little bit of high street, a little bit of ready to wear, a little bit down and dirty in that sense. I'm like, yeah, go on, give me the mass fashion. And one of my favorite objects has got to be Dot Cotton's coat. So if you are walking through the exhibition, you're walking past our kind of high street short storefronts, you will spot a coat that was worn extensively by June Brown, the actress in EastEnders, while playing the iconic character Dot Cotton. And it's made by a company called Alexon. And Alexon are probably one of the most significant British ready-to-wear companies of the 20th century. So founded by Alexander Steinberg, who is really rooted in that immigrant East End late 19th and early 20th century community. So he sets himself up in business in the very early 20th century and kind of grows with the advent of British ready to wear, but is known for making these kind of really high quality but fashionable tailored women's outerwear. And the Dot Cotton coat is such a fantastic example of that, because June Brown wore it on screen for years and years and years, but it was also actually purchased secondhand. So the costume department on EastEnders were very into authenticity and sort of thought that the character Dot Cotton would probably love a charity shop. So they used to try and purchase some of her pieces secondhand. And the condition of that coat is fantastic. And I said, for me, it's a real kind of testament. As you said, it's sort of that quite anti-fast fashion. It's that thing of going, actually, a lot of the ready-to-wear that was produced throughout the 20th century was incredible quality. And so I love it. But I also, I love the fact that it brings together these, for me, two very iconic people, because Alexander Steinberg was a kind of larger-than-life character. He had sort of factories in various places in the UK, but particularly in Wales, and he would kind of rock up like a film star to his factories and would sometimes actually bring other film stars with him to kind of show off how glamorous he was as this kind of figure from London. He had a country house, which he called La Cigale, because, you know, it's very, very chic. And I just sort of, I really love that these two people who for me are very important come together in this fabulous piece. So I said that story. And I think the story of kind of Jewish people's involvement in British ready-to-wear is really important for me, because they really helped democratize British fashion in the 20th century. They helped make fashion and like good quality fashion accessible to so many more people through technological innovation, through business innovation, through all these people who contributed to making these fabulous things. And yeah, I said, so that for me is a very powerful story, actually.
There's so many. It is like choosing your favorite child.
Sorry.
I just want to say I do really love, so Bethan wrote the chapter on high street and wholesale couture, and it is one of my favorite ones. Like I just love reading that chapter, because I think it teaches us so much, and if anybody reads that and enjoys it, they should definitely go and check out this Tregenza's book, Wholesale Couture, which is so important as a kind of deep dive on that part of the industry. I'm a big fan of our key figure chapters, the shorter chapters, which do deep dives. So, you know, Mr. Fish is somebody who I have spent a lot of time with, metaphorically, not in real life. And Otto Lucas is another one that I really loved writing, because I've been researching Otto Lucas, the milliner millionaire, for a few years now. But I think the Moss Bros chapter is one that brings Bethan and I both a lot of joy. Moss Bros is the only company that spans the entire date range of the book and the exhibition. So they're founded sort of It depends which piece of marketing you read, but around 1860. And of course, Moss Bros still going today, completely ubiquitous on the British high street, and has been a real, I would say, a cornerstone of British event dressing for, you know, a very long time now. And we were really lucky that the Moss Bros company today were very enthused about this project and invited Bethan and I to their head offices to dive through all their archival material. And we had the most delightful time looking at their beautiful marketing materials. And that is largely down to Harry Moss, who was the third family member to run the company, or the third governor, as he was known. And Harry Moss really pioneered marketing for his business, you know, sending out really pretty, well-designed materials to people in their homes that advertised what they could offer as a company, but also elevated the image of the company in the public eye, because what Moss Bros really sold was the aspiration of British society dressing. Another flip between the book and the exhibition. So one of the first objects you'll see in the exhibition is a men's coat from the first decade of the 20th century. And we've actually ended the book, the very end of the Moss Bros chapter ends with this garment. And I love this garment because it was donated to what was and will soon be the London Museum, which is what the Museum of London used to be called and is changing its name back to shortly. Harry Moss donated it as part of a group of clothing to the London Museum after he wrote a letter to the Times, sort of basically saying, I think somebody should be collecting contemporary menswear from this moment in the early, well, it was around, it was the 1940s. I think somebody should be collecting contemporary menswear to preserve this moment and, you know, recognise the importance of London tailoring. And the director of the London Museum, Mr. Grimes, after a delay of a couple of years, wrote to him and said, I'm actually interested if no one's taken you up on this yet. So there was some back and forth between the London Museum and the Moss Bros company. And we ended up acquiring 25 pieces of tailoring from across London, not just Moss Bros pieces. And there's this lovely exchange in one of the final letters where Mr. Grimes says, I do hope this will be just the start of the sort of Moss collection of menswear at the London Museum. And I just thought it was so poignant that these two men were thinking about the importance of preserving fashion from that moment in time, of preserving London tailoring. So to get to almost open the exhibition and close the book with that garment feels really poignant to me in thinking about the museum's role in preserving and telling the story.
How fascinating. Great choices, everybody. Loved them. Okay, so speaking of favorites, if you could pick just one favorite object from the exhibition or book, what would it be?
Well, we've already talked about my number one favorite, which is the Peggy Lewis dress. I will talk about another one, an amazing jacket, which is in the sort of menswear boutique section of the book and the exhibition. It's made by Irvin Sellers, who is a really interesting kind of retail entrepreneur who, you know, starts out on a market stall, creates a chain, various chains of boutiques, and later moves into property development and is responsible for building the Shard. So that's truly crazy. Changed the landscape of London, quite literally. It's a deep brocade. It's sort of yellow and gold. And it has this gold sort of tasseling. So it's made entirely from furnishing fabric, this green and gold sort of brocade style fabric. It's got this gold fringing. It's got a Nehru Indian inspired collar that was all the rage in the kind of late 60s, very much channeling the energy of the Monkees and other kind of bands of the moment. But because this is the Carnaby Street version, this garment is not well made, but that doesn't matter. That's not what it was for. It was about vibes, 100%.
We love a vibes-based garment situation.
It was just vibes. It was about capturing the zeitgeist. It was about responding quickly to trends. And that is what retailers like Irvin Sellers did so well, because they were producing in London. They could see what was happening and whip it up real quick. And I was really lucky that doing a deep dive of research into something completely unrelated, I found a photo of somebody wearing this jacket, which we didn't know existed. And there was, I would say, somewhat niche 60s band called The Mode. And I've been really trying to find out more about The Mode's career and haven't found a huge amount so far. So if there are any Mode fans listening, please get in touch. But there's a wonderful photo shoot which shows the band members all slightly awkwardly standing outside Walthamstow Town Hall. And one of them who on he's wearing this jacket and it's amazing. So I love what it represents. I love that moment in time. I love the sort of somewhat chaotic energy that came with these Carnaby Street looks.
Great choice. Love it. Bethan, tell me yours.
I am going to slightly cheat. If this was Desert Islanders, you might like kick me off for this. But I'm going to have a group of photos as my favorite object, which I think that works.
Yeah.
So if you go into the education section in the exhibition, or you look in the East End section of the book, you will see some of these. And these are photos from the Jews Free School in the early 20th century, and they are photos of classes that people are taking. Mm. And for me, there's something about, as I said, seeing all of these people whose names we're not going to know, you know, people who many of whom possibly did go off to work in the industry, because we know that there was a huge emphasis in the Jews Free School of getting people jobs in the industry, finding people apprentices. But it's them concentrating over knitting classes. It's them concentrating over, they're cutting miniature pinafores. They are learning these skills. And you can see on their faces these looks of absolute concentration and seriousness. And I love that these photos of these young people starting off on a journey where it makes you wonder, where did they go? What did they make? How did they contribute to the fashion city as they grew up? So for me, it's just, as I said, they're really special. And every time I look at them, I sort of spot a different person with a different fantastic facial expression. And again, it's just this sort of possibility of all these stories contained within these photos are really, really special.
So one other favorite that I have to sneak in is the garments made by the Ravis sisters. They were not the best liked people in the fashion industry, I think, is a very simplistic way to put this, but they had the best drama in their lives. Just yesterday, I was reading a wild news story about Ray Ravis being engaged to a man who'd been engaged to an actress just 10 days earlier and was previously married to a different actress. So, you know, there was scandal, there was drama, but they, what the Ravis sisters knew how to do, both in their personal lives and in the way they designed, was draw attention and make an impact. And we have two garments in the exhibition. One of them is a new acquisition. It is this gorgeous 1930s fishtail evening dress with a matching jacket. And it is completely covered in these tiny scallops of beading. And it is so impressive. It has to be seen in person. And the other garment is one that we've had in the collection for a while, but never fails to make an impact on people. It is a real showstopper, and it has this amazing, incredibly distinctive Ravis embroidery on it, which, I say Ravis embroidery, they famously said about themselves, neither of us knows how to sew a thread. What we know how to do is tell people, that basically they said, we know how to tell people what to do. That's what we're good at. We know they actually sent out their embroidery, but there's these amazing kind of chenille threads that are used to get texture. And then it has this pleat on the back, which is this deep pink godet down the back of the dress, and it's breathtaking.
No, I mean, I think you've got to mention the Rava sisters, because that 30s fishtail dress is sort
50s.
Of it's
you're talking about the pink one.
So the 30s fishtail one is, for me, it's just kind of like, if Art Deco was a dress, this would be it. And I remember, like, the first time I ever saw it, kind of opening that box and just this sort of shimmer. It was like a mermaid was inside the box, this sort of shimmering because of all of those little gold scallops on that fabric. Oh, just absolute magical object. And yeah, it looks so fantastic. Now it's all mounted. It was such a special piece to see mounted.
Great choices, everybody. You cover a lot of ground with that combo.
Every time somebody asks Lucy and I this question, we come up with different responses, which I think tells you something about actually how brilliant all of the stuff is.
It is just like, I am not a 20th century fashion person. I wear stuff from the 50s, but generally it's not the one for me. I tend to believe that 20th century fashion is like sideburns and corduroy and big lapels, but you can really see the love and the effort and the skill in all of these garments to the point where I really understand the appeal of it. I see how the trends change and I want to wear everything.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Your summary of 20th century fashion is fantastic. Yeah.
I'm waiting for like Isabella Rosner, the second book, Corduroy and Sideburns, the 20th century.
Oh my God, I feel people would just be so riveted by a book about sideburns and corduroy from yours truly. I'm on it. I'm on my way. Okay, the final question that I have to ask is, do you have anything you'd like to promote? I have a feeling you do.
You should definitely come to the exhibition. You should definitely buy the book.
Wow. And
I think you should do both, because actually both are a really nice accompaniment to each other. So the exhibition will allow you to actually get up close and personal with these pieces, which are so fabulous and really merit attention in person. And I said that, I mean, I have been so awed by how beautifully the team have put together this and dressed everything and lit everything. And I, the first time I walked through, when it was completed, I had a bit of a cry because it is so beautifully done.
Aww.
And the book will, Wizard, will kind of tell you so much more as well. It will allow you to kind of do a bit more deep dive into those. And the photography that has been done for the book is spectacular. So if you want to kind of, you know, keep hold of some of these pieces, or if you can't come to the exhibition, you want to get up close and personal, the book will allow you to do that as well, because the photography team have done such a fantastic job. I think that's fair to say, Lucy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we have a special offer on. So if you pre-order your book when you book an exhibition ticket, you get £5 off. So makes it very affordable. So check out the Museum of London website for that. I want to say, give you the information. So the exhibition is on at the Museum of London Docklands until the 14th of April. I would love to just say, because I think a lot of people listening might be interested in this, that we also have a great events program going on alongside the exhibition. So there are some wonderful talks, there's some workshops, and on the 25th of January, we are going to have a Fashion City late event. There is going to be cabaret, there will be pickles, there is going to be music, you'll be able to see the exhibition, Bethan and I will be doing tours, there's going to be a film screening, there is so much going on, and it's going to be such a fun evening, so please do come and join us for that.
Amazing. Thank you. And thank you both so much for talking to me today. It has been nothing but a joy. And honestly, what a great way to end the episode with a shout out to pickles. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Hi again. I absolutely loved chatting to Lucy and Bethan. It's honestly been so thrilling watching their journey from research project to exhibition to book. And what a thrill it is to see all of their hard work come to fruition. Fashion City features not only beautiful clothes, tools, and photographs, but also countless stories about human connection and community. We talked a lot about Stitch in this episode, about how so many of the garments on display and in the book are really beautifully crafted, and how Lucy and Bethan made a special effort to include unfinished items in order to show off the stitching and that process of making. After the interview, I couldn't help but think about the parallels between the physicality of those stitches and the themes of migration, movement, and community that come up so often in our conversation and in this podcast more generally. Stitches move and span great distances, just as these Jewish immigrants did, and each stitch comes together to create a strong seam. I feel that unity reflected in the people and objects Lucy and Bethan discussed in our chat. Here we have people from a variety of countries and socioeconomic backgrounds and even time periods, but they come together in this exhibition and book to tell a larger story about a really important part of London's history as an international fashion capital. Stitches reflect people, and people reflect stitches. Okay, that's it from me for this episode. I will be back with more So What goodness soon. Now go out and stitch some stories and go see Fashion City. And if you can't, get the book. Or even better, do both. Bye!